Oh, we're not here just to ramble on about baking baked goods and holidays about bunnies.
No, Riley.
Wow.
It's called
Not
Cast
even
Party.
Easter eggs,
No,
like
it,
coloring
Riley,
eggs.
it's called Cast Party. It's about the it's a
I mean,
podcast about theater,
you
you
could
know?
still bake and color eggs at a cast party.
You're right, but we talked about this.
We did.
Yeah. We made a point of saying that this is what our podcast is about,
I
you know?
know. It's about plays and reading
Branding.
them. Yeah.
Branding and all that.
I know.
And I'm Riley.
And welcome to the Cast Party,
the podcast where we read a play and talk about it.
We've got some good food,
some good friends,
and more than enough wine to go around.
Come on in.
Hey, Riley.
Hey, Kearney. I just worked from 8 to 5 today.
Gross.
Yeah, well, actually, I don't think I've told you this, but I just got a job at the local Board of Elections office.
Oh, look at you.
I know. And, like, Board of Elections might not sound very exciting, but, I mean, in this time of COVID-19, voting is still important, and it's important to elect officials that will lead our country and make it a better place. And I am currently helping out at the office with absentee ballots and getting them processed because the Ohio election just got postponed. So almost everyone is voting absentee now, which means they need a lot of extra help to process them. So
yeah,
2 days in a row, I worked 8 to 5 stuffing ballots all day. Go out there and vote, people.
Or rather, stay in and vote.
Yes, wait, do not go out. Please, 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 for the love of God, stay in your house. And apply for an absentee ballot and send that in.
Yes. Oh, man.
There we go.
There it is.
How are you?
I'm also tired. I
yeah.
have no reason to be tired like you. Because, I mean, all I did today was clean my house and go on a 3-mile walk, which is, like, nothing for me.
You know,
anyway,
like,
a 3-mile walk is not a lot for me. So.
But also, like, staying inside the house all day makes you very tired.
It's true. It does. And, like, especially, like, cleaning and, like, doing laundry is, like, one of the most exhausting things I've ever done in my life, you know?
Yeah. I just never have motivation to do stuff like that.
Yeah.
So that's why I never do it.
Yeah.
Just kidding.
Well,
I'm actually a very clean person, but
I am, too. Well, we had to take the pillow fort down today.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
That's so
She's
sad.
Gone. Yeah, but it was really nice to have, like, an actual adult living room.
Yes. Did you take,
like,
a picture of it?
Of the pillow fort?
Yes.
Yeah, I did. I have a picture.
We can post it on the podcast social media, too.
Yeah.
So everyone can see it. We can put it on Instagram.
Look at it.
Oh, my gosh. Wait, I just want to curl up in that and watch a movie so
bad.
It was
awesome. But, you know, after a week, it was driving both of us crazy. So we had to take it down.
You know what? I think I'm going to do it, though.
Yeah,
I think I'm
going
to gather my siblings together and say, hey, everybody, take all your pillows and bring them downstairs. And we're just going to... I just got Mario Party for my Switch. Because
lay in your pillow fort and play Mario Party.
Yes, with my siblings. Family
That's the
bonding
best.
Time.
Do it. It's so good.
Hey,
it's
guys,
fun.
We are really tired today. But we love you and we love plays and
we
theater
do.
And Shakespeare. So we're going to do this.
Yeah, we are. Great.
Come on, Kearney.
I'm rallying. I'm sorry.
We're going to do it.
We're
going to
do
this.
We're going to do this. Okay.
I want to talk about something else.
Yes, go.
So tomorrow is Easter. And I got home from work today, and I saw that my mom and my sisters just made a bunny cake. A bunny cake! It's
that's
a cake
funny.
That's shaped like a bunny, and it looks really good.
Oh my god, that's amazing.
I just had to tell you, because you like baking,
I do.
And I figured you would really appreciate it.
I do like baking. And that's another thing. My sourdough, it smells like actual sourdough today.
Nuh-uh.
Yeah.
That's a milestone.
I know. It's so great. I'm so proud of myself. But yeah, I can't wait to make a loaf of sourdough bread, probably sometime next week.
I'll be looking forward to it.
Look forward to it. I'll tell you guys all about it.
All right.
All right. Let's move into the reason we're actually here. Talking about the play.
Oh, we're not here just to ramble on about baking baked goods and holidays about bunnies?
No, Riley. It's called cast party.
Not even
party.
Easter eggs?
It's called cast party. It's about podcast about theater.
You could still bake and color eggs at a cast party.
You're right, but we talked about this.
We did.
Yeah. We made a point of saying that this is what our podcast is about.
I know. It's about plays and reading branding. Them. Yeah.
Branding and all that.
I know.
But also,
but alas,
I have so much fun doing, like, talking about Shakespeare, though.
Me too. I do. It's a lot of fun.
Now, shall we actually get into this and do a recap of Act 2 for everybody?
We shall.
All right, everybody. So, recap of Act 2. Here we go. Act 2 started out with Clawton, and we hear about a situation where we realize that he is probably a psychopath because he beat someone over the head for making fun of him. And then we move into Giacomo, who has hidden in a trunk that he got into Imogen's bedroom, and he comes out of the trunk, says a super creepy monologue, kisses her in her sleep, takes note of a lot of personal details and about a mole that's on her rib cage. Then Clawton wakes Imogen up with a song, and there's lots of jokes about sex. And then Imogen kind of lets Clawton have it and lets him know that she hates him and that he is no better than a piece of clothing that has barely touched Posthumus's body. And then she realizes that she's lost the bracelet and calls Pisanio to go and find it. Then we move on and we are back in Italy, and Giacomo convinces Posthumus that he has slept with Imogen and Imogen has been unfaithful. Filario tries really, really hard to make Posthumus calm down, but it doesn't work. And then Posthumus runs off in a rage. And then finally, Posthumus comes back on and has a misogynist monologue about how mad he is and how he's going to write books about how terrible women are. And that's the end of the act.
If you forget what happened in Act 2, feel free to give that episode a listen again, or you can look up a summary.
Yes.
But without further ado, shall we begin Act 3?
Take it away! No, we shall.
I like Take It Away. I think we can keep that in. I think that's good.
Okay.
That's fun.
Take it away.
Act 3, Scene 1, Britain. A hall in Cymbeline's palace. Enter in state Cymbeline, Queen, Clawton, and lords at one door, and at another, Caius Lucius and attendants.
Now say, what would Augustus Caesar with us?
When Julius Caesar, whose remembrance yet lives in men's eyes and will to ears and tongues, be theme and hearing ever, was in this Britain and conquered it, Cassibelan, thine uncle, famous in Caesar's praises, no whit less than in his feats deserving it, for him and his succession granted Rome a tribute, yearly £3,000, which by thee lately is left untendered.
And to kill the marvel. Shall ever be so.
There be many Caesars ere such another Julius. Britain is a world by itself, and we will nothing pay for wearing our own noses.
That opportunity, which then they had to take from To resume, we have again. Remember, sir, my liege, the kings, your ancestors, together with the natural bravery of your isle, which stands as Neptune's park, ribbed and paled in with oaks unscalable and roaring waters, with sands that will not bear your enemies' boats, but suck them up to the topmast, a kind of conquest Caesar made here. But may not hear his brag of came and saw and overcame with shame. The first that ever touched him, he was carried from off our coast, twice beaten, and his shipping, poor ignorant baubles, on our terrible seas, like eggshells moved upon their surges, cracked as easily against our rocks, for joy whereof the famed Cassibelan, who was once at point, oh, giglet fortune, to master Caesar's sword, made Ludstown with rejoicing, fires bright, and Britain strut with courage.
Come, there's no more tribute to be paid. Our kingdom is stronger than it was at that time, and as I said, there is no more such Caesars. Other of them may have crooked noses, but to owe such straight arms, none.
None, let your mother end.
We have yet many among us can gripe as hard as Cassibelan. I dare not say I am one, but I have a hand. Why tribute? Why should we pay tribute? If Caesar can hide the sun from us with a blanket or put the moon in his pocket, we will pay him tribute for light. Oh, sir, no more tribute. Pray you now.
You must know, till the injurious Romans did extort this tribute from us, we were free. Caesar's ambition, which swelled so much that it did almost stretch the sides of the world against all color here, did put the yoke upon us, which to shake off becomes a warlike people, whom we reckon ourselves to be.
We do.
Say then to Caesar, our ancestor was that Malmutius, which ordained our laws, whose use the sword of Caesar hath too much mangled, whose repair and franchise shall by the power we hold be our good deed. Though Rome be therefore angry, Mutius made our laws, who was the first of Britain, which did put his brows with golden crown and called himself a king.
I am sorry, Cymbeline, that I am to pronounce Augustus Caesar, Caesar that hath more kings his servants than thyself domestic officers, thine enemy. Receive it from me, then. War and confusion in Caesar's name pronounced I against thee. Look for fury not to be resisted. Thus defied, I thank thee for myself.
Thou art welcome, Caius. Thy Caesar knighted me. My youth I spent much under him. Of him I gathered honor, which he to seek of me again, perforce, behooves me keep at utterance. I am perfect that the Pardonians and Dalmatians for their liberties are now in arms. A precedent which not to read would show the Britons cold, so Caesar shall not find them.
Let proof speak.
His Majesty bids you welcome. Make pastime with us a day or two, or longer. If you seek us afterwards in other terms, you shall find us in our salt water girdle. If you beat us out of it, it is yours. If you follow the adventure, our crows shall fare the better for you. And there's an end.
So, sir?
I know your master's pleasure, and he mine. All the remain is welcome.
Exeunt. Scene 2. Another room in the palace. Enter Pisanio with a letter.
How? Of adultery? Wherefore write you not what monsters her accuser? Leonatus, oh master, what a strange infection is fallen into thy ear. What false Italian, as poisonous tongued as handed, hath prevailed on thy too ready hearing? Disloyal? No. She's punished for her truth, and undergoes more goddess-like than wife-like such assaults as would take in some virtue. Oh, my master, thy mind to her is now as low as were thy fortunes. How? That I should murder her? Upon the love and truth and vows which I have made to that command? I? Her? Her blood? If it be so to do good service, never let me be counted serviceable. How look I that I should seem to lack humanity so much as this fact comes to?
Reading.
Do it. The letter that I have sent her by her own command shall give thee opportunity. Oh, damned paper, black as the ink that's on thee. Senseless bauble, art thou a feudary for this act, and look so virgin-like without? Lo, here she comes. I am ignorant in what I am commanded.
Enter Imogen.
How now, Pisenyo?
Madam, here is a letter from my lord.
Who? Thy lord? That is my lord, Leonatus? Oh, learned indeed were that astronomer that knew the stars as I his characters. He'll lay the future open. You good gods, let what is here contained relish of love, of my lord's health, of his content. Yet not that we two are asunder, let that grieve him. Some griefs are medicinable, that is one of them, for it doth physic love, of his content, all but in that. Good wax thy leave, blessed be you bees that make these locks of counsel. Lovers and men in dangerous bonds pray not alike. Though forfeiters you cast in prison, yet you clasp young Cupid's tables. Good news, gods.
Reads.
Justice and your father's wrath, should he take me in his dominion, could not be so cruel to me as you, O the dearest of creatures, would even renew me with your eyes. Take notice that I am in Cambria at Milford Haven. What your own love will out of this advise you, follow. So he wishes you all happiness that remains loyal to his vow and your increasing in love. Leonatus Posthumus. Oh, for a horse with wings! Hear'st thou, Pisanio? He is at Milford Haven. Read, and tell me how far 'tis thither. If one of mean affairs may plod it in a week, why may not I glide thither in a day? Then, true Pisanio, who long'st like me to see thy lord, who long'st let me bait, but not like me, yet long'st, but in a fainter kind, oh, not like me, for mine's beyond, beyond. Say and speak thick. Love's counselor should fill the bores of hearing to the smothering of the sense. How far it is to this same blessed Milford, and by the way, tell me how Wales has made so happy as to inherit such a haven. But first of all, how we may steal from hence, and for the gap that we shall make it in time from our hence going and our return to excuse. But first, how get hence? Why should excuse be born or error begot? We'll talk of that hereafter. Prithee, speak. How many score of miles may we well ride twixt hour and hour?
1 score twixt sun and sun, madam, is enough for you, and too much too.
Why, one that rode to execution, man, could never go so slow. I have heard of riding wagers where horses have been nimbler than the sands that run in the clock behalf. But this is foolery. Go bid my woman feign a sickness. Say she'll home to her father and provide me presently a riding suit, no costlier than would fit a Franklin's housewife.
Madam, your best consider.
I see before me, man, nor hear, nor hear, nor what ensues, but have a fog in them that I cannot look through. Away, I prithee, do as I bid thee. There's no more to say. Accessible is none but Milford Way.
Exeunt. Scene 3, Wales, a mountainous country with a cave. Enter from the cave, Belarius, Guiderius, and Arviragus. Following.
A goodly day not to keep house with such whose roofs as low as ours. Stoop, boys, this gate instructs you how to adore the heavens and bows you to a morning's holy office. The gates of monarchs are arched so high that giants may yet jet through and keep their impious turbans on without good morrow to the sun. Hail, thou fair heaven! We house of the rock yet use thee not so hardly as prouder livers do.
Hail heaven.
Hail heaven.
Now for our mountain sport, up to yond hill. Your legs are young, I'll tread these flats. Consider, when you are above, perceive me like a crow, that it is place which lessens and sets off. And you may revolve what tales I have told you, of courts, of princes, of the tricks in war. This service is not service, so being done, but being so allowed to apprehend thus, draws us a profit from all things we see. And often, to our comfort shall we find the sharded beetle in a safer hold than is the full-winged eagle. Oh, this life is nobler than attending for a check, richer than doing nothing for a bauble, prouder than rustling an unpaid-for silk. Such gain the cap of him that makes him fine, yet keeps his books uncrossed, no life to ours.
Out of your proof you speak, we poor unfledged have never winged from view the nest, nor know not what errs from home. Haply this life is best, if quiet life be best, sweeter to you, that have a sharper known, well corresponding with your stiff age. But unto us it is a cell of ignorance, traveling a bed, a prison for a debtor that not dares to stride a limit.
What should we speak of when we are as old as you? When we shall hear the rain and wind beat dark December, how in this our pinching cave shall we discourse the freezing hours away? We have seen nothing. We are beastly, subtle as the fox for prey, like warlike as the wolf for what we eat. Our valor is to chase what flies. Our cage we make a choir, as doth the prisoned bird, and sing our bondage freely.
How you speak! Did you but know the city's usuries, and felt them knowingly, the R to the court is hard to leave as keep, whose top to climb is certain falling, or so slippery that the fear's as bad as falling. The toil of the war, a pain that only seems to seek out danger, in the name of fame and honor, which dies of the search, and hath as oft a slanderous epitaph as record of fair, act, nay, many times, doth ill deserve by doing well. What's worse, must curtsy at the censure. Oh, boys, this story the world may read in me. My body's marked with Roman swords, and my report was once first with the best of note. Cymbeline loved me, and when a soldier was the theme, my name was not far off. Then was I as a tree whose boughs did bend with fruits, but in one night, a storm or robbery, call it what you will, shook down my mellow hangings, nay, my leaves, and left me bare to weather.
Uncertain favor.
My fault being nothing, as I have told you oft, but that two villains whose false oaths prevailed before my perfect honor swore to Cymbeline I was confederate with the Romans. So followed my banishment, and this 20 years, this rock and these demesnes have been my world, where I have lived at honest freedom, paid more pious debts to heaven than in all the fore end of my time. But up to the mountains. This is not hunter's language. He that strikes the venison first shall be lord of the feast. To him the other two shall minister, and we will fear no poison which attends in place of greater state. I'll meet you in the valleys.
Excellent.
How hard it is to hide the sparks of nature. These boys know little that they are sons of the king, nor Cymbeline dreams that they are alive. They think they are mine, and though trained up thus meanly in the cave wherein they bow, their thoughts do hit the roofs of palaces, and nature prompts them in simple and low things to prince it much beyond the trick of others. This Polydore, the heir of Cymbeline in Britain, who the king his father called Guiderius, Jove, when on my 3-foot stool I sit and tell the warlike feats I have done, his spirits fly out into my story, say, thus mine enemy fell, and thus I set my foot on his neck. Even then the princely blood flows in his cheek. He sweats, strains his young nerves, and puts himself in posture that acts my words. The younger brother Cadwal, once Arvigarus, in as like a figure, strikes life into my speech and shows much more his own conceiving. Hark, the game is roused. Oh, Cymbeline, heaven and my conscience knows, thou didst unjustly banish me, whereon at 3 and 2 years old I stole these babes, thinking to bar thee of succession, as thou reft'st me of my lands. Euryphile, thou wast their nurse. They took thee for their mother, and every day do honor to her grave. Myself, Bellarius, that a Morgan called, they took for their natural father. The game is up.
Exit. Scene 4, country near Milford Haven. Enter Pisanio and Imogen.
Thou told'st me when we came from horse, the place was near at hand. Ne'er longed my mother so to see me first as I have now. Pisanio, man, where is Posthumus? What is in thy mind that makes thee stare thus? Wherefore breaks that sigh from the inward of thee? One but painted thus would be interpreted a thing perplexed beyond self-explication. Put thyself into a havior of less fear, ere wilderness vanquish my statier senses. What's the matter? Why tenderst thou that paper to me with a look untender? If it be summer news, smile to it before. If winterly, thou needst but keep that countenance still. My husband's hand, that drug-damned Italy hath out-craftied him, and he's at some hard point. Speak, man, thy tongue may take off some extremity, which to read would be even mortal to me.
Please you, read, and you shall find me, wretched man, a thing the most disdained of fortune.
Thy mistress, Pisanio, hath played the strumpet in my bed. The testimonies whereof lie bleeding in me. I speak not out of weak summarizes, but from proof as strong as my grief and as certain as I expect my revenge. That part thou, Pisanio, must act for me. If thy faith be not tainted with the breach of hers, let thine own hands take away her life. I shall give the opportunity at Milford Haven. She hath my letter for the purpose where, if thou fear to strike and to make me certain it is done, thou art the pander to dishonor her and equally to me disloyal.
What shall I need to draw my sword? The paper hath cut her throat already. No, 'tis slander, whose edge is sharper than the sword, whose tongue out-venoms all the worms of Nile, whose breath rides on the posting winds and doth belie all corners of the world, kings, queens, and states, maids, matrons, nay, the secrets of the grave, this viperous slander enters. What cheer, madam?
False to his bed. What is it to be false? To lie and watch there and to think on him? To weep twixt clock and clock? If sleep charge nature, to break it with a fearful dream of him and cry myself awake, that false to bed, is it?
Alas, good lady.
Why false? Thy conscious witness, Iachimo, thou didst accuse him of incontinency. Thou then look'st like a villain. Now methinks thy favor's good enough. Some jay of Italy, whose mother was her painting, hath betrayed him. Poor I am stale, a garment out of fashion, and for I am richer than to hang by the walls, I must be ripped to pieces with me. Oh, men's vows are women's traitors, all good seeming by thy revolt. Oh, husband, shall be thought put on for villainy, not born to where it grows, but worn a bait for ladies.
Good madam, hear me.
True, honest men being heard like false. Yes, I don't know. We're in his time, though false. And Sinan's weeping did scandal. Many a holy tear took pity from most true wretchedness. So thou, Possumus, wilt lay the leaven on all proper men. Goodly and gallant shall be false and perjured from thy great fall. Come, fellow, be thou honest. Do thou thy master's bidding. When thou seest him, a little witness my obedience. Look, I draw the sword myself. Take it, and hit the innocent mansion of my love, my heart. Fear not, 'tis empty of all things but grief. Thy master is not there, who was indeed the riches of it. Do his bidding. Strike thou mayst be villain in a better cause. But now thou seem'st a coward.
Hence, vile instrument, thou shalt not damn my hand.
Why? I must die. And if I do not by thy hand, thou art no servant of thy master's. Against self-slaughter there is a prohibition so divine that cravens my weak hand. Come, here's my heart. Something's a fort. Soft, soft. Will no defense, obedient as the scabbard. What is here? The scriptures of the loyal Leonatus all turn to hearsay. Away, away, corruptors of my faith. You shall no more be stomachers to my heart. This may poor fools believe false teachers, though those are betrayed. Do feel the treason sharply, yet the traitor stands in worse case of woe. Thou Posthumus, that didst set up my disobedience against the king my father, and make me put into contempt the suits of princely fellows, shalt hereafter find it is no act of common passage, but a strain of rareness. And I give myself to think, when thou shalt be disedged by her, that now thou tirest on, how thy memory will then be pranged by me. Prithee, dispatch. The lamb entreats the butcher. Where's thy knife? Thou art too slow to do the master's bidding when I desire it to.
Oh, gracious lady, since I received command to do this business, I have not slept one wink.
Do it and to bed then.
I'll wake mine eyeballs blind first.
Wherefore then didst undertake it? Why hast thou abused so many miles with a pretense? This place, mine action and thine own, are horse's labor, the time inviting thee, the perturbed court, for my being absent, whereunto I never propose return. Why hast thou gone so far to be unbent when thou hastn't taken thy stand, the elected deer, before thee?
But to win time, to lose so bad employment, in the which I have considered of a course. Good lady, hear me with patience.
Talk thy tongue, weary, speak. I have heard I am a strumpet, and mine ear, therein false struck, can take no greater wound, nor tend to bottom that, but speak.
Then, madam, I thought you would not back again.
Most like, bringing me here to kill me.
Not so, neither. But if I were as wise as honest, then my purpose would prove well. It cannot be but that my master is abused. Some villain, aye, and singular in his art, hath done you both this cursed injury.
Some Roman courtesan?
Woe on my life. I'll give but notice you are dead, and send him some bloody sign of it, for 'tis commanded I should do so. You shall be missed at court, and that will well confirm it.
My good fellow, what shall I do the where? Where bide, how live, or in my life, what comfort? When am I dead to my husband?
If you'll back to the court.
No court, no father, nor no more ado with that harsh, noble, simple nothing, that Cloten, whose love suit hath been to me as fearful as a siege.
If not at court, then not in Britain must you bide.
Where then? Hath Britain all the sun that shines? Day, night, are they not but in Britain? In the word's volume, our Britain seems as of it, but not in it. In a great pool of swan's nest, prithee think, there's livers out of Britain.
I am most glad you think of other place. The ambassador, Lucius the Roman, comes to Milford Haven tomorrow. Now, if you could wear a mind dark as your fortune is, and but disguise that which to appear itself must not yet be but by self-danger, you should tread a course pretty and full of view. Yea, happily, near the residence of Posthumus, so nigh at least that though his actions were not visible, yet report should render him hourly to your ear as truly as he moves.
Oh, for such means! Though peril to my modesty, not death on it, I would adventure.
Well then, here's the point. You must forget to be a woman. Change command into obedience. Fear and niceness, the handmaids of all women, or more truly, women, its pretty self, into a waggish courage. Ready in gibes, quick answered, saucy and as querulous as the weasel. Nay, you must forget that rarest treasure of your cheek, exposing it, but oh, the harder heart, alack, no remedy, to the greedy touch of common kissing Titan, and forget your laborsome and dainty trims wherein you make great Juno angry.
Nay, be brief. I see into thy end, and almost a man already.
First, make yourself but like one. For thinking this, I have already fit, 'tis in my cloak bag, doublet, hat, hose, all that answer to them. Would you in their serving, and with what imitation you can borrow from youth of such a season, for noble Lucius present yourself, desire his service, tell him wherein you're happy, which you'll make him know, if that his head hath ear in music. Doubtless with joy he will embrace you, for he's honorable, and doubling that, most holy. Your means abroad you have me, rich, and I will never fail beginning nor supplement.
Thou art all the comfort. The gods will diet with me. Prithee away. There's more to be considered, but will even all that good time will give us. This attempt I am a soldier to, and will abide it with a prince's courage. Away, I prithee.
Well, madam, we must take a short farewell, lest being missed I be suspected of your carriage from the court. My noble mistress, here's a box. I had it from the queen. What's in it's precious. If you are sick at sea or stomach qualmed at land, A dram of this will drive away distemper, to some shade and fit you to your manhood. May the gods direct you to the best.
Amen. I thank thee.
Exeunt severally. Act 3, Scene 5, A Room in Cymbeline's Palace. Enter Cymbeline, Queen, Cloten, Lucius, Lords, and Attendants.
Thus far, and so farewell.
Thanks, royal sir. My emperor hath wrote, I must from hence, and am right sorry that I must report ye my master's enemy.
Our subjects, sir, will not endure this his yoke, and for ourself to show less sovereignty than they must needs appear unkinglike.
So, sir, I desire of you a conduct over land to Milford Haven. Madam, all joy befall your grace.
My lords, you are appointed for that office. The due of honor and no points admit. So farewell, noble Lucius.
Your hand, my lord.
Receive it friendly, but from this time forth I wear it as your enemy.
Sir, the event is yet to name the winner. Fare you well.
Leave not the worthy Lucius, good my lords, till he have crossed the Severn. Happiness.
Exeunt Lucius and lords.
He goes hence frowning, but it honors us that we have given him cause.
'Tis all the better. Your valiant Britons have their wishes in it.
Lucius hath wrote already to the emperor how it goes here. It fits us therefore ripely, our chariots and our horsemen be in readiness. The powers that he already hath in Gallia will soon be drawn to head. From hence he moves his war for Britain.
'Tis not sleepy business, but must be looked to speedily and strongly.
Our expectation that it would be thus hath made us forward. But my gentle queen, where is our daughter? Hath she not appeared before the Roman? She hath not appeared before the Roman, nor to us hath tendered the duty of the day. She looks us like a thing more made of malice than of duty. We have noted it. Call her before us, for we have been too slight in sufferance.
Royal sir, since the exile of Posthumus, most retired hath her life been, the cure whereof, my lord, 'tis time must do. Beseech your majesty, forbear sharp speeches to her. She's a lady, so tender of rebukes that words are strokes, and strokes death to her.
Re-enter attendant.
Where is she, sir? How can her contempt be answered?
Please you, sir, her chambers are all locked, and there's no answer that will be given to the loudest noise we make.
My lord, when last I went to visit her, she prayed me to excuse her keeping close, whereto, constrained by her infirmity, she should that duty leave unpaid to you, which daily she was bound to proffer. This she wished me to make known, but our great court made me to blame in memory.
Her doors locked? Not seen of late? Grant heavens that which I fear prove false.
Exit.
Son, I say follow the king.
That man of hers, Pisanio, her old servant, have not seen these 2 days.
Go look after.
Exit Cloten.
Pisanio, thou that standst so for Posthumus, he hath a drug of mine. I pray his absence. Proceed by swallowing that, for he believes it is a thing most precious. But for her, where is she gone? Haply despair hath seized her, or winged with fervor of her love, she's flown. To her desired Posthumus gone she is, to death or to dishonor. And my end can make good use of either. She being down, I have the placing of the British crown.
Re-enter Cloten.
No, shit. How now, my son?
She's fled. Go in and cheer the king. He rages. None dare come about him.
All the better may this night forestall him from the coming day.
Exit.
I love and hate her, for she's fair and royal, and that she hath all courtly parts most exquisite, then ladies, woman from every one, the best she hath, and she of all compounded outsells them all. I love her, therefore, but disdaining me and throwing her favors on the low Posthumus slander so her judgment that what else rare is choked. And in that point, I will conclude to hate her. Nay, indeed, to be revenged upon her. For when fools shall... Who's there?
Enter Pisanio.
What are you packing, Sirrah? Come hither. Ah, you precious pander. Villain, where is thy lady? In a word, or else thou art straightway with the fiend.
Oh, good, my lord.
Where is thy lady, or by Jupiter? I will not ask again. Close, villain. I'll have the secret from thy heart, or rip thy heart to find it. Issue is posthumous, from whose so many weights of baseness cannot a dram worth be drawn.
Alas, my lord, how can she be with him? When was she missed? He is in Rome.
Where is she, sir? Come here. No further halting. Satisfy me home what is become of her.
Oh, my all-worthy lord.
All-worthy villain! Discover where thy mistress is at once. At the next word, no more of worthy lord. Speak, or thy silence on this instant is thy condemnation and thy death.
Then, sir, this paper is the history of my knowledge touching her flight.
Presenting a letter.
Let's see it. I will pursue her even to Augustus' throne.
Or this, or perish. She's far enough, and what he learns by this may prove his travel, not her danger. I'll write to my lord she's dead. Oh, Imogen, safe mayest thou wander, safe return again.
Sir, is this letter true?
Fair as I think.
It is posthumous hand, I know it. Sirrah, if thou wouldst not be a villain, but do me true service, undergo these employments wherein I should have cause to use thee with this serious industry. That is, what villainy soe'er I bid thee do, to perform it directly and truly. I would think thee an honest man. Thou shouldst neither want my means for thy relief, nor my voice for thy preferment.
Well, my good lord.
Wilt thou serve me? For since patiently and constantly thou hast stuck to the bare fortune that beggar posthumous, thou canst not, in the course of gratitude, but be a diligent follower of mine. Wilt thou serve me?
Sir, I will.
Give me the hand. Here is my purse. Hast any of thy late master's garments in thy possession?
I have, my lord, at my lodging, the same suit he wore when he took leave of my lady and mistress.
The first service thou dost me, fetch that suit hither. Let it be thy lint service. Go.
I shall, my lord.
Meet thee at Milford Haven. I forgot to ask him one thing. I'll remember it anon. Even there, thou villain posthumous, will I kill thee. I would these garments will come. She said upon a time, the bitterness of it I now belch from my heart, that she held the very garment of posthumous in more respect than my noble and natural person, together with the adornment of my qualities. With that suit upon my back, will I ravish her. First kill him, and in her eyes, there shall she see my valor, which will then be a torment to her contempt. He on the ground, my speech of insultment ended on his dead body, and when my lust hath dined, which, as I say, to vex her I will execute in the clothes that she so praised, to the court I'll knock her back, foot her home again. She hath despised me rejoicingly, and I'll be merry in my revenge.
Re-enter Pisanio with the clothes.
Be thou those the garments?
Aye, my noble lord.
How long is it since she went to Milford Haven?
She can scarce be there yet.
Bring this apparel to my chamber. That is the second thing that I have commanded thee. The third is that thou wilt be a voluntary mute to my design. Be but duteous, and true preferment shall tender itself to thee. My revenge is now at Milford. Would I had wings to follow it. Come, and be true.
Exit.
Thou bidst me to my loss, for true to thee were to prove false, which I will never be to him that is most true. To Milford go, and find not her whom thou pursuest. Flow, flow, you heavenly blessings on her. This fool's speed be crossed with slowness. Labor be his meed.
Exit. Scene 6, Wales, before the cave of Belarius. Enter Imogen in boy's clothes.
I see a man's life is a tedious one. I have tired myself, and for two nights together have made the ground my bed. I should be sick, but that my resolution helps me. Milford, when from the mountaintop Pisanio showed thee, thou wast within a ken. O Jove, I think foundations fly the wretched, such I mean where they should be relieved. Two beggars told me I could not miss my way. Will poor folks lie that have afflictions on them, knowing 'tis a punishment or trial? Yes, no wonder when riches one scarce tell true. To lapse in fullness is sorer than to lie for need, and falsehood is worse in kings than beggars. My dear lord, thou art one of the false ones. Now I think on thee my hunger's gone. But even before, I was at the point to sink for food. But what is this? Here's a path to it, to some savage hold. I were best not to call. I dare not call. Yet famine, ere clean it o'erthrow, nature makes it valiant. Plenty and peace breeds cowards. hardness ever of hardiness's mother. Ho, who's here? If anything that's civil, speak. If savage, take or lend. Ho, no answer? Then I'll enter. Best draw my sword, and if mine enemy but fear the sword like me, he'll scarcely look on't. Such a foe, good heavens.
Exit to the cave. Enter Bellarius, Guiderius, and Arviragus.
You, Polydote, have proved best woodsman and our master of the feast. Codwell and I will play the cook and servant. 'Tis our match. The sweat of industry would dry and die, but for the end it works too. Come, our stomachs will make what homely savory weariness can snore upon the flint, when rusty sloth finds the down pillow hard. Now peace be here, poor house that keeps thyself.
I am thoroughly weary.
I am weak with toil, yet strong in appetite.
There is cold meat to the cave. We'll browse on that whilst what we have killed be cooked.
Stay, come not in. But that it eats our victuals, I should think here were a fairy.
What's the matter, sir?
By Jupiter, an angel, or if not, an earthly paragon. Behold divineness, no elder than a boy.
We enter Imogen.
Good masters, harm me not. Before I entered here, I called, and thought to have begged or bought what I have took. Good troth, I have stolen not, nor would not, though I had found gold strewed in the floor. Here, money for my meat. I would have left it on the board so soon as I had made my meal and parted with prayers for the provider.
Money, youth?
All gold and silver rather turn to dirt, as 'tis no better reckoned but of those who worship dirty gods.
I see you're angry. No, if you kill me for my fault, I should have died had I not made it.
Whither bound?
To Milford Haven.
What's your name?
Fidel, sir. I have a kinsman who is bound for Italy. He embarked at Milford, to whom, being going almost spent with hunger, I am fallen in this offense.
Prithee, fair youth, think us no churls, nor measure our good minds by this rude place we live in, well encountered. 'Tis almost night. You shall have better cheer ere you depart, and thanks to stay and eat it. Boys, bid him welcome.
Were you a woman, youth, I should woo hard, but be your groom. In honesty, I bid for you as I'd buy.
I'll make it my comfort. He is a man. I'll love him as my brother. And such a welcome as I'd give to him after long absence such as yours. Most welcome. Be sprightly, for you fall amongst friends.
Amongst friends, if brothers. Would it have been so, that they had been my father's sons? Then had my prize been less, and so more equal belasting to thee, Posthumus.
He rings at some distress.
Would I could free it.
Or I, whate'er it be, what pain it cost, what danger, gods.
Hark, boys.
Great men, that had a court no bigger than this cave, that did attend themselves and had the virtue which their own conscience sealed them, laying by that nothing gift of differing multitudes, could not outpeer these twain. Pardon me, gods. I'd change my sex to be companion with them, since Leonatus is false.
It shall be so. Boys, we'll go dress our hunt. Fair youth, come in. Discourse is heavy, fasting. When we have supped, we'll mannerly demand thee of thy story, so far as thou wilt speak it.
Pray, draw near.
The night to the owl, and the morn to the lark less welcome.
Thanks, sir.
I pray, draw near.
Exeunt. Scene 7. Rome, a public place. Enter two senators and tribunes.
This is the tenor of the emperor's writ, that since the common men are now in action against the Pelonians and Dalmatians, and that the legions now in Gallia are full weak to undertake our wars against the fallen-off Britons, that we do incite the gentry to this business. He creates Lucius preconsul, and to you, the tribunes, for this immediate levy, he commends his absolute commission. Long live Caesar!
Is Lucius general of the forces?
Aye.
Remaining now in Gallia?
With those legions which I have spoke of, whereunto your levy must be suppliant. The words of your commission will tie you to the numbers at the time and the time of their dispatch.
We will discharge our duty.
Exeunt.
Let's do this.
Let's do it. Scene 1. Kearney, would you like to start?
Sure. So Act 3, Scene 1, we start out in the court of Cymbeline, and Caius Lucius, who is the emissary and a general from Rome has arrived, and they all get upset at each other. Mostly Clotin and the Queen are very dramatically speaking, and the Queen has this beautiful monologue that I loved saying, and it's so much fun, but Clotin kind of interrupts it, which I think is funny. So, like, she's still speaking and she's halfway through a line, and then Clotin is like, no, 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 no more tribute. We're not giving you any more tribute. And I think it's super funny. And then Cymbeline even says, son, let your mother finish. Like, and then Clotin just keeps talking because he just doesn't care. And in the scene, they all make declarations of war and everything. And then they're like, great, you're welcome. Let's go grab a bite to eat, shall we? Very funny that Cymbeline and Caecilius are still friends.
Yeah, their whole relationship is hilarious.
Yeah.
Like, they are just the worst mother and son combination ever.
I know.
I mean, anytime Clotin opens his mouth, you know it's going to be some dumb shit. And the queen is just this evil queen who wants to be evil and just wants... To me, she seems like a wannabe evil queen. Like, she's just not good at being an evil queen.
She's not.
She's not good at it. She tries so hard.
She's trying. She has this whole big monologue and she's doing so great and sounds so dramatic and sounds so evil queen. And then Clotin interrupts her. And it's just, it's so funny.
It's so good. Go Shakespeare.
Oh, such a funny scene.
I can talk about scene two.
Yeah.
So in scene two, Pisanio receives a letter from Posthumus accusing Imogen of infidelity and asks him to lead her away from London and murder her. Pisanio, who is horrified, doesn't want to do it. He gives Imogen another letter from Posthumus asking her to meet him in Milford Haven off the coast of Wales.
Yeah. And then, you know, Imogen comes in and reads the letter and is so happy. But Imogen keeps asking Pisanio how long it will take them, and she's like, no, and he says how long, and she's like, no, you can't be right, we have to be able to go faster than that. And he tries to be like, no, but wait, you should think about, and she's like, no, we're gonna go right now.
Poor Pisanio.
Yeah,
he doesn't want to do any of this, but he just has to.
He doesn't.
It is funny how Imogen just takes charge of the whole situation
because she's a princess. He kind of has to do what she says, you know.
Yeah, but like, instead of Pisanio, you know, like, but it's okay, I will still take care of you, like, I'm not gonna do this. He just doesn't know what to do. He doesn't know what to do, and she's just like, okay, well, we're gonna do this then.
Yeah. And the thing is like, he's just read the letter, so he hasn't had time to come up with anything to do anyway.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so and she comes in right away and doesn't give him time to think of something. So he wants her to wait until he can think of something to fix it. Great. Do you want to move on to scene three then?
Let's do it. So scene three is Bellarius and his sons, Polydor and Cadwal. But as we find out shortly within this scene, Polydor and Cadwal are actually Guiderius and Arviragus, who are the sons of King Cymbeline.
Dun, dun, dun!
Dun! And this is revealed through a soliloquy that Bellarius gives to the audience. I think it's very funny how it happens, actually, because he's just kind of talking to his quote-unquote sons, who are actually just people that he has stolen.
Yep.
And basically is like, all right, go away now, go away, sons. And then immediately walks to the audience and says, hey, I have a big secret. These are not my sons at all.
Yeah, it's very funny. But this scene does such a good job of introducing these characters.
It's so well written.
Like, Bellarius, so he talks so much all of the time. And throughout the rest of the play, he talks too much for too long. But Guiderius and Arviragus they're being raised as simple folk in Wales.
Shepherds.
And yeah, and they live in a freaking cave.
A cave. They are
live in
cavemen.
A freaking cave. One could consider them as like like the archetype of ancient Britons within the play, because everybody else is very Renaissance acting and presenting as like courtly culture and everything, but these are the Britons in the play. And the reason Shakespeare picked Wales to put them in is because the Welsh people are considered to be the descendants of the original Britons. A lot of them moved into what is now Wales during the Norman invasion. So that's really fascinating. And it also does a great job of presenting them as like they're very well educated. Belarius has educated them.
I was going to say, they still speak in verse.
Yeah.
They don't speak in prose, whereas usually in Shakespeare's plays, if, you know, the courtly characters all speak in verse, and a way to differentiate between a courtly character and a character of lower status is they speak in prose.
Yeah.
Without the rhythmical...
iambic pentameter.
Yeah, exactly. I know that's what it is.
I know you know.
My brain is very slow right now.
Without the iambic pentameter.
Without the iambic pentameter. Without that rhythm. But yeah, you can clearly tell from the moment they open their mouths that they have still been educated by Belarius because of that. I see what you did there, Shakespeare.
It also presents Belarius as a character and like brings up his past, and he talks about his history in the court and that he was one of Cymbeline's trusted advisors, but was banished for treason, which he did not commit, but other people were jealous of his status in court and made up lies about him. And he was banished by Cymbeline on pain of death. And because of his banishment, he stole Cymbeline's sons and their nursemaid helped him. And then he married her and she was their mom for their childhood and everything. So,
oh, Belarius.
He's probably one of the best roles in this show, you know?
Yeah. Well, guess we'll find out what he does.
Yep. Let's move on to scene four.
Kearney, you got this one.
Oh, I do. Okay, this one's fine. Great. In scene four, we meet Imogen and Pisanio in the forest, and they have been traveling. Pisanio chooses this moment to reveal to her what is really happening, and they're in the middle of the woods and there's nobody around, and so he gives her the letter and she reads it and goes off into her long monologues about how Posthumus could think that she's false. And they're really like, oh, they're so well written and they're so good. And then Imogen pulls out Pisanio's sword and holds it in front of her heart and says, kill me or I will do it myself. And then Pisanio then tells her about his plan and everything, and that she has to go and leave Britain and disguise herself as a man. As a woman, you couldn't just wander around the forest of Wales, but as a young boy, you could. And then he tells her that she should go get a position with Caius Lucius because he will take her back to Rome with him as his page. And she'll be near to Posthumus until Pisanio and her can figure out what to do. He also says she will want for nothing because he'll support her and take care of her. And she doesn't have to worry about money or anything because he'll send her all of his money. Isn't that sweet?
So sweet. And Imogen is so smart. Like, she's so intelligent. Because she guesses that Posthumus must have been deceived by someone else into thinking that Imogen is unfaithful. She suspects, not specifically Iachimo, but she suspects someone. That shows that she is really smart. Yeah. She and how well she knows Posthumus, that he has a few anger issues.
Yep.
Maybe more than a few.
Yeah. And but, I think it's important to note that she so very quickly comes out of wanting to be killed and wanting to kill herself. And I think this line, her line here is important. when Pisanio tells her, if not at court, then not in Britain you must bide. And she says, where then hath Britain all the sun that shines day, night? Are they not but in Britain? In the world's volume, our Britain seems as of it, but not in't. In a great pool, a swan's nest. And it's great because this is a moment she's had no hope. This is the point where she realizes, oh, I can go somewhere else, because she can't go back to court. She can't go to Posthumus.
Yeah. And it's also her big turning point and kind of like in who she is too, because she's been the princess. She's realizing that, like you said, yes, she can overcome this, but she's going to have to do things she's never done before to achieve them.
Yeah.
Her goals. And
yes.
It's just beautiful. It's beautiful. That monologue also really stood out to me. And there, in a lot of stories, you know, there's that moment where the character kind of realizes their own potential. And when they realize that they can get what they want.
Yeah.
Like, that they will succeed. And they have it in themselves to do it. And that's what Imogen is realizing.
Yeah. And then at the end of the scene, Pisanio says he can't go with her. But here is a box with a potion in it that the queen gave me. If you remember, all the way back in Act One, the queen gave Pisanio what she thinks is poison, but what the doctor has really made just a sleeping potion.
But Pisanio thinks it is medicine.
Yes, Pisanio thinks it's medicine because that's what he's been told it is. Like, I don't think he believes that the queen would actually be capable of killing anybody.
Yeah.
Because he's never, like... Yeah, I don't know. We've gone down a rabbit hole. Let's move on to the next scene.
I think we're going
to
cut out a lot of that. So.
Yeah, a lot of it's going to be gone anyway, so.
All right, let's move on to scene 5.
Woohoo! Take it away, Riley.
Oh, it's me now.
It is.
All right, let's see. Scene 5, after Imogen and Pisanio, we have Cymbeline the Queen, Cloten, and Lucius, along with some lords and attendants, back at Cymbeline's palace. So in the beginning of this scene, Cymbeline, the queen, and Cloten bid farewell to Caius Lucius. The king asks to see Imogen and sends a messenger to fetch her, but the messenger returns saying that her bedroom is locked and she has not been seen in days. Bum, bum, bum! So, obviously, this causes anxiety for the royal family. However, Cloten plots his revenge on Imogen and Posthumus. Pisanio comes in after returning from Wales. Cloten basically plagues him with interrogations of where Imogen has gone. Pisanio was very smart and knows that Imogen has had enough time to get away. So sends Cloten on what he knows will be a wild goose chase. So then Cloten, foolish and stupid as he is, Cloten puts on Posthumus's clothes and plans to kill him and then rape Imogen while wearing Posthumus's clothes.
He somehow thinks that he'll be able to have sex with Imogen wearing Posthumus's clothes and that she like won't know it's him. So he just clearly does not understand how sex works at all.
Or just common sense.
Yeah. And he's saying, oh, I'm going to beat her up a bit and then bring her back to court. And her dad won't be too mad.
Well, if Cymbeline is a good father, he should be pretty upset.
Oh, but oh my God. It's just this end of this scene is so important to be done well and taken seriously. Because this is supposed to be the moment we realize how dangerous and evil Cloten really is.
Yeah.
Because He may be stupid, but he is still a bad person. And I think it's very easy to make it sound like still the ridiculous Cloten. That just makes it seem unimportant when actually it is quite important to know he's intending to do these awful, terrible things. Let's dive into scene 6. So in the beginning of the scene is Imogen walks on disguised as a boy. And she talks about how it must be boring to be a man. And then she ends up seeing the cave, which is Belarius, Avaragus, and Guiderius's cave. She goes into it looking for food. And then Belarius, Guiderius, and Arviragus come back in and see that someone is in their cave. And they go in and look, and Imogen comes out and asks them not to hurt her. She offers them money, and at which point they're like, money? Like, why would we need that? We don't need money. And then they make friends. It's really beautiful that they instantly trust her and think of her as a family member. And I think it's very beautiful.
Because she is.
Yeah, she is.
She's and her then, sister.
Yeah, and it's wonderful because she has this line. They say, oh, well, you know, I'll love you as my brother and everything. And she says, if brothers, would it had been so that they had been my father's sons? And it's so beautiful because they are.
It's so cute.
It is. It's a testament to Imogen as a character that they instantly trust her.
Yeah.
And it's also Shakespeare gave her the name when she's in disguise. Fidel!
But I was going to point this out too, because it means fidelity, faithfulness.
In Italian and French, it means the faithful one. Like Shakespeare not giving her a nod that she is innocent and like she's such a good human being. You know when you look at a person and you just know they're good and you know that you can trust them? It's this kind of situation with Imogen. Is Belarius, Guiderius, and Arviragus take one look at her and know that she is trustworthy. And that happens throughout the entire play, is every time someone takes a look at her or meets her, they're like, you're trustworthy.
No, yeah, I was going to point that out too, because Fidel, meaning, you know, fidelity, faithfulness, that is so astounding to me that that is the name that Imogen chooses to give herself, because it reflects the whole reason she's doing what she's doing too, which is to prove to Posthumus that she is faithful, that she did not do what he is accusing her of. It's cool. Our name, which identifies who we are, when they ask her who she is, she says, I'm faithful. That's who I am.
Yep.
Like that's literally what she's saying. Awesome.
And going back to the beginning of the scene, another of my favorite lines, it's the very first line of the scene, and it's, I see a man's life as a tedious one. Which is really, really funny, because it's so funny. Often back then, misogynistic views made out women's lives to be so boring and so tedious, and women had nothing to do. And now Imogen is getting a taste of a man's life, and she's like, well, this is awful.
She goes, ugh, being a man sucks.
Being a man sucks.
But another reason, another indication of where Shakespeare is a feminist. You can't argue that. Can't argue with that line there.
Can't argue.
So that was scene 6.
Riley, do you want to do scene 7?
So scene 7 is a very, very short scene, and it takes place in Rome. A public place, to be exact, according to the script, enters two senators and tribunes. We find out that Rome is now waging war on Britain. Ah!
Dun, dun, dun!
And then that is the end of Act 3.
Yeah. I don't think I've ever seen this scene. I've seen Cymbeline a couple times.
Did you perform it?
No.
This scene?
No.
I was wondering that when I was reading it too. I thought, this is so short. I wonder if they didn't even stage it in your production, because...
Yeah, they didn't.
It's so short.
It was gone. It was pointless. I don't even know why it's really in the play, because it doesn't give any new information at all.
It doesn't, but it just seems like... It seems to me like this is where you would put intermission right after this. I feel like the only reason it would be there is to foreshadow what's to come and get people excited for the next half of the play, you know? Yep. All right, we just wrapped up the first half, and oh, what's this though? Like some Roman senators and tribunes that walk out on stage, and oh my gosh, they've announced the war! Like, it just seems like it's there for dramatic effect.
There we are. Well,
there we are.
Y'all, that's Act 3. Thank you all for tuning in for Act 3.
Next week, Act 4.
Let's go.
Thanks for tuning in, everyone. Feel free to email us at castpartypodcast@gmail.com with any questions, comments, play requests,
Literally anything. We would love to hear from you guys, even just feedback about this podcast. This is the first season, and we love constructive criticism, and would love to hear ways on how to make it better and what you guys want
to
hear.
Thanks for listening to The Cast Party.
The Cast Party is produced by Kearney Johnson and Riley Wilson.
Feel free to like us on Facebook and follow us on Instagram or Twitter at The Cast Party Pod.
That's all for now. See ya!